If you like what you hear on the Security Ledger podcast, you might want to check out one of our cybersecurity newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can sign up for them at securityledger.com/subscribe. Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Security Ledger. In this week's episode number 80, we look at advanced persistent threat, or APT, actors three different ways with three different experts offering their take on the world's most sophisticated hacking groups. Juan Andreas Guerrero Saad of the firm Recorded Future updates us on the doings of the North Korean hacking cell known as Lazarus Group, and Emily Miller of the firm Okana reports back from last week's S4 conference in Miami on developments in the case of Trisys, a family of malicious software that was found on safety and control systems at facilities in the Middle East. But first, in our January Security Ledger Spotlight podcast, John Condra, the director of Asia Pacific Research at the firm Flashpoint, talked about some of that company's findings in its latest Business Risk Intelligence Decisions report. In our first segment this week, we're going to reprise that conversation to hear John talk about how geopolitical factors influence online operations by nation-backed APT groups. To start off, I asked John to talk about one of the report's more interesting claims, that Russia may be rethinking the wisdom of its online intelligence operations, given the repercussions, including tighter sanctions in the U.S. With us now on the Security Ledger podcast, we have John Condra, who's the director of Asia Pacific Research at Flashpoint. John, welcome to Security Ledger podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Your Business Risk Intelligence report, it's actually a really fascinating read. And one of the conclusions you reach is that there's evidence to suggest that Russia may be doing a little bit of recalibrating after some of their successes, for example, in the U.S. election, and weighing the long-term effects or the efficaciousness of some of these info ops. I think most people in the U.S. would say, well, that was a very successful operation. You know, the Russian government or intelligence services got pretty much everything they wanted out of that. But as to read this, you might think, well, maybe not.
Yeah, so yeah, you make a good point. A lot of the narrative, especially in the media right now, is about how Russia manipulated the election. And I'm going to try to avoid political commentary as much as possible, but it's inevitable to some extent. And helped get Donald Trump elected. That's kind of the narrative, right? The way I see it, and again, this is my opinion in this sense, is, and I have seen this articulated elsewhere. And if you go and look back at kind of what's happened post the election of Donald Trump, post the U.S. election, and after what happened after the Macron hacks in France, and the inaction that Germany, that APT28, which is the organization that allegedly targeted the U.S. and France. The inaction in the German elections earlier this year, you start to wonder why they didn't intervene, or maybe why they're not being as they haven't seemed to have gotten at least what they wanted out of, or what we assume that they wanted out of their campaign against the United States. I think when you're thinking about this, you have to kind of start thinking about the assumptions that you're making, and a lot of assumptions that are made in the current narrative start from the foundation of Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin wanted to get Donald Trump elected. And they intervened in a way to get that to happen. I don't know if we know that for a fact. I don't know if the Kremlin even expected that these operations would have as much success as they did in that sense. There's been some speculation that Vladimir Putin, A, harbored a particular grievance against Hillary Clinton, and so maybe he was just trying to sabotage her career. And then there's an element of just maybe they just wanted to cause chaos in the U.S. political system, U.S. society more broadly. And if that was the case, I think they've succeeded beyond all doubt there. It's hard to say whether or not they actually expected to get or even wanted to get Donald Trump elected. I do think they probably had the expectation, given some of the conversations that took place during the course of the run-up to the election, that Donald Trump would be soft on Russia or would be more conciliatory and maybe not impose sanctions, whereas that the exact opposite has shown to be true. And so I think what might be happening back in Moscow, and usually when you have these types of operations, you reassess after the fact. You go back and say, okay, what did we achieve? Did we achieve our strategic ends? And if we didn't, what kind of blowback are we now facing? And what Russia is now facing is increasing isolation in the international community, anger across Western Europe in particular for some of their efforts, in particular in France, as well as obviously the United States. The ongoing investigation is a problem for them. And there's a general consensus that Russia is not friendly towards Western democracies right now. And that is a problem for them going forward, especially if we're talking about, you know, the imposition of sanctions and how that might affect life on the street in Russia. I think it's probably fair to say that there's some level of introspection going on within Russia, and whether I'm right on this, I'll probably never know.
You know, one of the things that the Business Risk Intelligence report makes note of is the interplay between what we would think of as kind of traditional geopolitical tensions between countries, let's say now, you know, in the Middle East between Iran and Saudi Arabia, or on the Korean Peninsula between North and South Korea and China, and kind of how those influence what might be happening or not happening online. What's the best way to understand how those things interplay and interact?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I guess the fundamental takeaway of this is that none of this is happening in a vacuum. Everything that happens online is fundamentally part of the human experience, and is driven by, in large part, geopolitical trends. Whether you have access to a particular website based on what country you live in, that is a decision made at a policy level within the country. And that also shapes perceptions of how that country is viewed by others. And so there's a lot that goes into this, but it's there should be no illusions that what takes place online is in a vacuum isolated from the real world. So in that sense, my favorite example of this from 2017 in particular is some activity that we observed earlier this year, in particular between China, South Korea, and the United States. And I'll kind of walk you through it. And this really should show how geopolitical tensions and ongoing conflict in real life affect the security posture of organizations who are not necessarily even directly related to the issue at hand in the cyber domain. So earlier this year, I think it was in March, if I'm not mistaken, a new high-impact vulnerability in Apache Struts 2, CVE 2017-5638, was released or was discovered and dropped out of China in particular. This happened to coincide with a land swap agreement between a South Korean conglomerate named Lotte and the South Korean government. And so what happened here was the South Korean government bought a piece of land of a golf course, in particular from Lotte, in order to deploy the Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System, or otherwise known as THAAD. And this is a short-range ballistic missile defense system with highly advanced radar that can stretch several hundred miles, even into Chinese territory, and obviously North Korea. And the intent here was, the stated intent of the United States and South Korea here was to obviously defend South Korea from North Korean aggression. Well, China didn't like that very much because we could see into their territory, and obviously North Korea didn't like it for obvious reasons. And what ended up happening, I'll spare you the geopolitical consequences here, suffice it to say that there was a lot of protests on both sides. China, in particular Chinese threat actors, and in particular the Chinese hacktivist community, which has been dormant for several years for the most part, started leveraging this vulnerability in Apache Struts 2 very quickly against Lotte. Lotte's website in China went down very fast. A lot of their various different domains were also targeted. And then not long after that, we started seeing attacks using the same tools against American entities, and including financial institutions. These are companies that really didn't have anything to do with the THAAD dispute at all, but are targets of opportunity. They're seen as extensions of American power. They are, you know, in that sense, they're elements, they're symbols of America. They're symbols of the American intervention in East Asia. And so they found themselves targeted by it. So that's my favorite example of how kind of the geopolitical trends can blend over to cyberspace from 2017.
Yeah. It's like the example I always use, right, going back a few years to, you know, how Sony ended up targeted by Anonymous because of a lawsuit they filed against against George Hotz, right, for hacking the, you know, PlayStation 3 or whatever it was. I'm sure for Sony, that series of events was completely unpredictable, right? That by filing a lawsuit against this teenager, that suddenly your whole company was going to become the target of, you know, hacktivists. But the two were actually really tightly interwoven.
Exactly. And you could say the same thing, I would think, about the Sony Pictures Entertainment hack a few years ago, 2014.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know of anybody who could have predicted that North Korea was going to react like that. And that's fundamentally, that's obviously something of concern. And that's one reason why we actually avoided making hard predictions in this report, is because of those types of events. There's really no way to predict things accurately, and you always kind of put yourself in a box when that happens. So the best thing you can do is to make an honest and objective assessment of the landscape and say, here's the threats that I need to focus on.
I mean, you raise an interesting question too, which is in each of these countries, you have nation state actors, might even be military units that are part of the official military structure that do cyber operations. But then you also have these kind of loosely affiliated hacker groups that might look like hacktivists who are ideologically motivated and might be, but might also be a part of the official cyber offensive capability of the country as well, especially in a country like China that keeps such a tight rein on people's doings online. And how can you separate out vigilante operations by hacktivist groups in China from government sanctioned activity?
Sure. I was going to say that's a very good question, and I do wish I had a better answer for you. It's often the case that you can't tell the difference. There have been a lot of rumors about this type of, I guess you could call it moonlighting over time as well, and that's maybe a different concept, but similar. And it is hard to distinguish between what is true nation state activity versus what is hacktivist activity on occasion, especially when nation states use the hacktivist iconography or banners, etc., for the purposes of kind of obscuring their activities. And so I would say it's very hard to do. It can happen periodically. You can make those connections periodically if you get in large ways lucky, but usually making those connections requires some secondary sourcing of new information, usually not from online, that is usually not generally the purview of private sector companies.
John Kondra, Director of Asia Pacific Research at Flashpoint, thank you so much for coming on Security Ledger podcast. It was great having you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Paul. Appreciate your time.
Up next, the firm Recorded Future recently published a report on the doings of the North Korean hacking collective known as Lazarus Group, which included stepped-up activities against cryptocurrency exchanges and the destructive WannaCry wiper attack. To start off, Juan Andreas Guerrero Saad talks about what the Lazarus Group was up to in 2017, and we discussed how North Korean hackers are notable not so much for their skill as for their willingness to cross boundaries and violate international norms.
Juan Andres Guerrero Saade, Principal Security Researcher for the INSIC Group at Recorded Future.
Juan, welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Recorded Future this week released a pretty comprehensive report looking back over 2017 and some of the activity we saw from North Korea. They've had a very active year. What types of things did we see from groups that we believe are North Korean hackers in 2017?
The Lazarus Group has been fairly active over the past 2 years, definitely over 2016, 2017, doing some things that I think many of us in the threat intel industry would have considered outlandish half a decade ago, but are now have become sort of part of the common landscape. Amongst them, you know, the infamous WannaCry attack, the now very notorious Swift banking attacks, and, you know, these sort of large-scale attempts at getting a whole lot of money that, you know, they never quite seem to go the way they'd like. They don't seem to be the most careful operators, but they're definitely, I think, blowing our minds in what a, you know, nation-state-sponsored group would be willing to do.
Willing to do seems to be the operative term with North Korea. It seems like they're mostly distinguished by the fact that there really are no holds barred, that they do things that other nations and nation state groups would not consider doing because of the, among other things, the diplomatic repercussions or the repercussions for the country.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting sort of bit of geopolitics there, where you have to consider that rationality in international relations tends to have to do with self-interest. So the more that you isolate a country or that they isolate themselves, the less likely they're willing to, you know, sort of play by these natural incentives. So you get a very interesting situation where that spills over into cyber and saying, hey, you know, normally we'd consider wiper sabotage attacks to be off the table, or for the most part off the table. We would consider, you know, financial crime to be something unthinkable for you know, the actual hand of a government to be part of some kind, something like a bank heist. But in the case of, you know, the Lazarus Group, those things are just not off the table at all, nor is something like ransomware, which we tend to consider sort of small scale cybercrime. They were willing to take it up several notches. So very interesting group all the time.
From a targeting perspective, one of the things that you note in your report is that North Korean hackers have traditionally focused their energies on their sworn enemy of South Korea, but that they have really broadened their net and are now targeting many different countries and many different types of organizations. Talk about that evolution.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, one of the ways that it was really easy to find Lazarus Group activity over the past few years, over the past maybe 7 or 8 years, was that you could count on them hitting South Korea in some way. So they would go after South Korean institutions, government institutions, after their defense sector, just about anything. You know, they'd hit Samsung. Fairly predictable. Anything where South Korea placed value, the Lazarus Group would suddenly pop up in one way or another. More recently, since we're starting to see this sort of evolution of the Lazarus Group really getting very intensely focused on financial crime, we started to see some very interesting things when it comes to targeting cryptocurrency exchanges. And normally, I didn't really understand the subtext in the Korean Peninsula about cryptocurrency until I started kind of, you know, looking into the story and started researching some of these samples and then realized that apparently South Korea is the Bitcoin, like the mother of the Bitcoin frenzy in a lot of ways, lots of exchanges. And it seems that the Lazarus Group is seizing on that opportunity and saying, hey, you know, this is a good place to start getting some currency to trade with. So we've seen them targeting these cryptocurrency exchanges in interesting ways.
You know, the backstory here is obviously the regime is desperate for cash. They're isolated from most of the world financial institutions and networks because of the sanctions against them. But they obviously are very ambitious in terms of what they want to do, among other things, the nuclear weapon program. So they're looking for money. And that's why you have this nation state group that's acting kind of like a cyber criminal group. What types of things have we seen them do vis-a-vis this whole Bitcoin economy or ecosystem?
The first time we saw them essentially sort of grazing the land of cryptocurrencies was with WannaCry. That was obviously a failed attempt as a ransomware. And there's an interesting conversation to be had there about whether they actually intended it to be as big as it was, which I'm on the camp that says they did not. But beyond that, you know, they've gone on to targeting these cryptocurrency exchanges more directly. So what we're seeing them do is they load up these Hangul documents, these HWP files. And basically what Hangul is a sort of a Microsoft Office suite that is primarily used in South Korea. It's maintained by a local company called Hangcom. And what's interesting is you'll see very specific actors taking the time to develop exploits for Hangul because it's such a small payoff. You know, with a Microsoft Office 0 day, you could go and, you know, take that just about anywhere in the world and you're going to find targets that's going to, you know, give you a great return on investment for developing that exploit or buying that exploit. But when it comes to, you know, Hangul exploits, you're saying, well, we primarily care about South Korea and just about nobody else. So it was really interesting to see the Lazarus Group come up with yet another one of these Hangul exploits for a vulnerability that was discovered in 2017 and is patched already in GhostScript. But that doesn't seem to have kept them from taking advantage of it and using it to target very specific South Korean targets, amongst them these cryptocurrency exchanges.
Hey, this is Paul from the Security Ledger. If you're hearing my voice now, it means that you're a loyal listener of the Security Ledger podcast. To thank you for listening, we've got a special Easter egg offering, a one-of-a-kind Security Ledger t-shirt with a cool custom IoT security-themed artwork. Quantities are limited. To get yours, just go to securityledger.com/t-shirt and fill out the order form. We'll ship it to you, and be sure to include the special code to qualify for the order. That is SLT 2018. SLT as in Security Ledger, T as in t-shirt, 2018 as in it's 2018. One of the really interesting things about North Korea, obviously how isolated the country is, called the Hermit Kingdom for a reason, to the extent that they have cyber offensive capabilities or cyber capabilities in any form, they're the direct result of, you know, government programs and more specifically military programs to promote that. Without much of a native computer user base within the country, what do we know about kind of where they learn how to do the hacking that they do? And do you see any hints within either their attacks or their tools, techniques, and processes that indicate where they're learning how to do what they do and, you know, where the code that they're using might come from or be copied from?
Well, so there's a lot of interesting theories about that. Of course, like you say, for a country where the internet use is so controlled and you don't actually have unsanctioned access to the rest of the world, you are definitely discussing a very interesting nation state sponsorship scheme when it comes to a threat actor that you wouldn't be able to in, you know, just about any other country in the world. So a lot of, you know, researchers have taken the time and basically said, well, you know, is it the Chinese? Is it the Russians? Is it, you know, India? Are they going to school somewhere else? Are they, you know, there's a lot of theories about how some of these general hacking procedures are being developed and where that's coming from. And honestly, I don't think that we quite have it nailed down. But there are some interesting overlaps where we can, of course, see we've seen them, you know, coming out of China in interesting ways because of potential routing links for the internet. We've seen them trying to do false flags with Russian language before, which the researchers over at BAE discovered that around the time that, you know, the Swift attacks were getting popular. They found them misusing Russian terms. So, you know, that can point you in either direction, whichever way you want to look at it. And one thing that we had in this particular campaign that I was very interested in was if you look at the Hangul exploit that they were using, it actually includes several Chinese terms in it. That's a moment that, you know, kind of made us pause and sort of reconsider, because, of course, the really simplistic understanding of it is to say, well, you know, maybe there's some kind of operational overlap between the Chinese and the Lazarus group. So that, you know, that's something that we would love to actually find the proof for that, because you could say, well, you know, this is an established link of where they might be getting some of their exploit supply chain and some of their operational abilities, is maybe that's kind of like a brain exchange in a sense. In this case, I think it's too small and too simple to be able to say that properly. I think some of the theories that we're gravitating towards say, well, it's either another attempt at a false flag where they pepper some Chinese terms into the most visible part of their attack chain, or you could talk about a Chinese exploit supplier. So if you are stealing all these Bitcoins and you can't, you know, maybe you can't necessarily cash them out quite as effectively as you'd like to, because that's another discussion to be had with cryptocurrencies. Then another way to invest your ill-gotten gains is just to buy more tools that are going to enable your hacks, like, you know, better zero days. So are they getting their exploits from a Chinese supplier? Possibly. I mean, that's one of those regional dynamics that we've yet to really properly understand, but it seems reasonable.
Where do you see things going in 2018? Do we see a scaling back or a recalibration, or is it damn the torpedoes and full steam ahead?
I don't see anything that's genuinely offering a deterrent for the Lazarus group to continue to operate the way that it is. So I don't see those operations scaling down. I do expect them to get maybe a little more nuanced when it comes to the financial crime. I mean, you're talking about, you know, Swift has banded together with several security vendors. They're definitely a lot more conscious and doing a lot more work to try to button down the general Swift messaging system, make sure these sorts of attacks are less likely. And, you know, cryptocurrencies are changing by the minute. So what looks really profitable one day might not be the next day. And we're definitely going to see the Lazarus group. I don't think they're going to be any less interested in financial gain, but we're definitely going to see them starting to adapt to some of the constrictions of those particular ecosystems.
Juan Andreas Guerrero-Saad, thank you so much for coming on the Security Ledger podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate it.
And finally, the 2018 S4 conference recently wrapped up in Miami. It's one of the most prominent gatherings of experts in the cybersecurity of industrial control systems. In our final segment, we invited Emily Miller of the firm Mocana on to talk about one of the highlights of this year's S4, a presentation on the recent Trisys or Triton attack, in which malware targeted a Triconix industrial control safety system at a facility in the Middle East. I started by asking Emily to tell us what new we learned about the Trisys attack at S4.
My name is Emily Miller. I am the Director of National Security and Critical Infrastructure Programs with Mocana Corporation.
Emily, welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. It's great to have you on.
Good to be on, Paul. Thank you so much.
Okay, so you're back from sunny Miami and the S418 conference. This is an annual conference that focuses on cybersecurity for industrial control systems. One of the big reveals this year at S4 was from the folks at Schneider Electric, who talked about the Triton or Trisys attack in Saudi Arabia. What did we learn about this attack?
Well, we know from the reporting with FireEye, Dragos, and DHS the basics of the attack. And then what we learned from Schneider is that they have Vince found a vulnerability, a zero-day vulnerability in the firmware of the Tritonics. And that was pretty interesting. The attack was designed to target safety instrumentation systems, which is not something we've seen before, and then potentially manipulate the firmware on that safety controller.
First of all, remind us, what do these Tritonics devices do?
But in general, safety controllers are the last line of defense in a process control system, is where if something goes kind of kablooey in the process, the safety instrumentation system is there to make sure that it doesn't actually cause an impact. So what they do really depends on what the process is doing. So if you have an oil and natural gas refinery versus a chemical processing plant versus a food processing facility, they're all going to have a different nature and flavor of what was going on. So because this, we know it was somebody generally in the energy industry, I'm not going to kind of focus on attribution. We know it was probably someone in the oil and natural gas industry. It was probably controlling an oil and natural gas process. But the Tritonic controller is your, let's make sure the crap doesn't really hit the fan and something doesn't go kaboom. It's going to stop all of that from happening.
Often kind of physical type consequences, or, you know,
Absolutely.
Equipment being damaged or people around that equipment being hurt potentially.
Right. And it really depends on the process. And I look at this from, I come out of the federal government where I've been focusing on the 16 critical infrastructure sectors. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about safety instrumentation systems, that can be anything from talking about with the Tritonics impact all the way to looking at food process, pharmaceuticals, safety instrumentation systems can stop a chemical release, that sort of thing. And that's really what you want to think about in the context of what makes this such an interesting and novel attack. Yes, we can talk about the specifics, but that we're talking about the end of the line in terms of what's going to protect critical infrastructure from a physical impact that's either going to impact the safety and integrity of the process or the actual safety of the plant itself.
And what do we know about what happened in this TriSys attack? And did we learn anything new at this S4 conference about what the attackers were able to do at this facility?
It was an engineering workstation that was remotely accessible on the internet. So they got in via a PC kind of based attack, which we've seen before. And then they were able to pivot to this safety instrumentation system, the Tritonics controller. And the Tritonics controller itself was misconfigured. So it was left in program mode. And program mode means that you can go in and manipulate and make changes. If it had not been program mode, if it was in and run, some have been a little bit more difficult. We can't say for sure that they wouldn't have been able to execute, but it would have been much more difficult to do so. So because they had an internet accessible device that was connected to this controller, they were actually able to deliver a payload onto the Tritonics firmware. So that is the remotely accessible Trojan, the rat, that Schneider revealed was able to access the firmware. So this malware found a vulnerability in the Tritonics firmware on older Tritonics systems. So they got in with this rat, but the rat tripped probably unintentionally. The actors probably weren't expecting this to happen, but caused an error in the actual SIS system itself. And that's what caused the operators to notice that something was going on. And they didn't know initially that it was a cyber attack. And you'll see this a lot. Something will happen in the process. The safety instrumentation system did what it was supposed to do. And they went, huh, well, that's strange. It shouldn't have done, nothing appears wrong. So maybe this is a software issue. So they called Schneider and said, Schneider, we think this is a software issue. Schneider poked around and said, doesn't really look like it. And that's what kind of hit off the investigation with FireEye, Dragos, and DHS. It's all kind of working in this around the same time.
Mm-hmm. So a more polished attack that didn't cause that crash potentially might have gone unnoticed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here's the cool thing. The level of sophistication that these actors had to have to know the system, how to get into the system, how to poke around on the safety instrumentation system, what to actually deliver to the safety instrumentation system, probably means they had sophisticated knowledge of this facility. So, you know, you can extrapolate from there. What does that mean? Was it an insider? Is it somebody that had been sitting on their network for quite some time, poking around? We can draw all sorts of conclusions from that. And that, I think, should really make people sit up and take notice. Because if this hadn't tripped, they could have gathered up a ton of knowledge about how the operations were working, how the safety process system was working, and figure out what they could do in the future to impact the process. So the safety instrumentation system doesn't impact the process itself, but you could manipulate the firmware, send bad data back to the engineering workstation, and also have a concurrent attack. So something's going wrong, they've manipulated the safety controller, the last line of defense is compromised. And that really should make people very worried.
It's really interesting you know, you talked about the fact that the thing was in program mode. And I remember reading that, I think, in a Drago's report as well. So I remember reading that detail and thinking, huh, does that mean that there was an insider? And I kind of reach out to I'm on a SCADA and ICS mailing list and sort of said, does this mean that there's somebody on the inside who put this system into program for the purpose of, you know, getting malware, being able to write malware onto the system? And the response back was basically like, no, it's not that unusual that the system would be in program mode like that, because you often need to do updates. You're often loading new software on systems that might be physically remote. Or if you're in Saudi Arabia, they might be pretty close, but you've got to walk out into 115 degree weather to like go and turn that key. And so you leave it in program just so you don't have to do that, right? So it's kind of this, you know, as we often talk about, you know, it's like the layer 8 vulnerability. It's humans sort of saying, ugh, you know, it's just easier if I leave it this way. I can do it from my desk. I don't have to get up and walk out into the really hot desert weather to go do this thing.
Absolutely.
Which is both understandable, but also like, well, how do you protect against that? How do you get people to reprioritize and say, well, no, you know, this is really, even though it seems like a remote risk, it's actually not that remote. And we need to really be a lot more security conscious than we're being.
Core network architecture, misconfigurations, all of that is extremely common. And if you actually look at ICS search reports in the last couple of years, there are major issues that they're finding in these assessments, which I think they do, you know, 100 to 140, somewhere thereabouts a year, is very basic security controls. Network architecture, misconfiguration, identity authentication, least functionality, all of that type of stuff that's happening across, you know, critical industries. Now, there's a ton of work on how do you change human behavior. I mean, there's best practices, there's security controls, and, you know, folks I've talked to, and I used to design exercises as well, where you test this kind of thing, and they go, no, that'll never happen. That is not the best practice. That's really not good cyber hygiene. That's not what you're supposed to do. And I said, I know, you're right. That's not what you're supposed to do, but it's what happens.
But I'm seeing it all over the place, right?
Right. I literally have seen this at facilities that are not just small to mid-sized facilities. I mean, think about, you know, big, super major oil and natural gas facilities. I can only imagine when you have 100,000+ devices in facilities that have been open for 20-plus years, and they've had to develop these architectures while they're building in, you know, new processes, new facilities, new technologies, how messy it gets. So if you say, you know, we start from scratch and build a brand new facility and make the perfect architecture, or do you say, okay, now we're going to go back in and reconstruct everything? No. And then on top of that, the methodologies now, which are, the answer is yes to all of this. I'm about to say I'm going to both deride it and, you know, promote it, which is the defense in depth methodology. So making sure that you have a layered approach, detection, monitoring, hunting, threat intelligence, cyber hygiene, security controls, best practices, all of that, absolutely yes, but still getting in. And what are they doing when they're getting in? They're figuring out what your network is up to, probably better than you are. They're developing command and control executables, and they're going to try to cause bad things, either so that we know that they have the ability to cause bad things, or to keep that functionality to themselves so they can cause an impact just like what we saw in the Ukraine.
Stuxnet was 2009, and that was certainly a wake-up call. It took a few years, but we're now at the point where we are starting to see what we could consider cyber-physical types of attacks, both in the Ukraine and now this crisis. So there does seem to be a ramping up where these attacks for a long time were more or less theoretical to them now being practical. You were just at S4. Do you think that awareness has dawned on these critical infrastructure owners and operators that is the case, that they no longer can take it for granted that software-based attacks will not be used to disrupt their facilities?
Yes and no. I do think that end users particularly are aware. I think you see it most especially in the traditional control systems environments. So chemical, oil, natural gas, electricity, these types of industries who have very traditional control systems environments are very much aware of some of the security threats. But then you have the larger universe of the critical infrastructure that doesn't see itself, A, in the news, B, there are really, you know, when I left the government, there was not real reporting in terms of what we were seeing, you know, for threat information other than the industries that I just mentioned, and that's all publicly available. So when you think about the security community that was at S4, very traditional control systems universe, but these types of scenarios and these types of attacks are not limited to that which is traditional industrial controls. And so, you know, you start thinking about the buzzword bingo of IoT, and what does that mean? Basically, if it is an internet-connected device that controls the physical process, it's a control system. And whether you know, call it ICS or IIoT or IoT, it's all the same type of environment and all has the same kind of potential risks that could be leveraged against it. And I think getting sectors beyond those that are traditional control systems environments or traditional industrial environments to understand, recognize, and figure out what to do about these threats is a much more difficult question. And I think something we need to start talking more broadly about, and particularly with safety instrumentation systems now having a proof of concept, demonstrable impact that your safety systems, which are not just existing in traditional control systems environments, can be impacted, and that your last line of defense may not be able to defend you. That should make everybody really hyper aware.
Emily Miller McConnell, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to the Security Ledger podcast. It was great talking to you.
Hey, Paul, it was great talking to you, and feel free to call me back anytime.
Absolutely, we'll do it again.